Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the U.S. Embassy in Liberia is hit by mortar fire. We'll have the latest.
Newly declassified intelligence says U.S. officials knew early on that Saddam Hussein wouldn't share weapons with terrorists unless he was cornered, as he now is.
Senator Edward Kennedy says it's time to get the U.N. involved in Iraq.
Now we are in a situation where we have a bankrupt, failed, flawed policy in Iraq that's adrift, and American servicemen are paying the price every single day. It's like a shooting gallery over there.
Also, the rifle that changed the world, the AK-47, and its anguished creator.
And the folk music of summer.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A contingent of U.S. Marines has arrived at the U.S. Embassy compound in the capital of Liberia as heavy fighting between government troops and rebel forces engulfed the city. About 4,500 more U.S. Marines and sailors have been ordered to positions closer to Liberia to be ready for possible deployment in the war-torn country. At least 50 people have been killed in today's fighting, which NPR's Jason Beaubien says has been intensifying.
The shelling has been almost constant for the last 2 hours in this area. And in addition to the shelling, there's a lot of small arms fire in the streets. And at this point, most people are trying to seek shelter wherever they can find it.
NPR's Jason Beaubien at the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia. Angry Liberians lined up more than a dozen corpses on the street across from the embassy after a shell hit an American diplomatic compound where thousands of Liberians have taken refuge. A Palestinian militant was killed overnight in a bomb attack on a military vehicle near the West Bank city of Jenin, according to the Israeli army. Israeli forces also seized an explosive belt near Nablus today. NPR's Peter Kenyon has more.
An Israeli military source said an army patrol came under attack near Jenin shortly before midnight Sunday when a Palestinian set off a roadside bomb near their vehicle. The army said the Palestinian was killed and the vehicle was damaged, but no soldiers were injured. In Nablus, soldiers seized and safely detonated a bomb belt containing between 20 and 35 pounds of explosives. Six Palestinians in the area were arrested for questioning. The incidents came after the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers held their fourth meeting on the latest peace efforts. It produced no new agreements. Meanwhile, an Israeli court revealed that two Jewish settlers, now in Israeli custody, are suspected of being part of a terror cell that attempted to carry out attacks against Palestinians. Israeli police say they caught members of the group planning a bomb at an East Jerusalem school. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
The Attorney General of Massachusetts, Tom Riley, has decided not to seek criminal charges against senior officials of the Roman Catholic Church in Boston. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
An attorney representing clergy abuse victims says that's a disappointment. Months ago, Attorney General Riley accused the church of an elaborate scheme and cover-up of the abuse allegations, but said Massachusetts law made it difficult to win criminal indictments. Riley's report, which will be released later this week, also details what the archdiocese can do now to protect children in the future. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Boston.
Lance Armstrong recovered from a spill from his bike today to win a grueling mountainside climb in the Tour de France. With just a few stages left, Armstrong is holding the overall lead in his quest to win a fifth straight championship. Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 95 points at 9,093. Trading has been light so far today. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is off 30 at 1678. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have been trading lower today as the market braces for the next wave of second-quarter earnings reports. A third of the firms making up the S&P 500 index will post their results this week. The market weakness today has been led by tech sector stocks and telecom shares, but some selling was expected after last Friday's rally. A closely watched barometer of future economic activity rose again in June. Steve Beckner of Market International reports.
The conference board's index of leading indicators rose 0.1% last month. Though less than expected, it was the third straight monthly gain for the index, designed to forecast economic activity over the next 6 months. Conference board economist Ken Goldstein said the flat trend in the index over the past year may have ended, but added additional months of growth are needed to determine if an upward trend has indeed developed. Four of the 10 indicators that make up the index rose in June, led by growth in the money supply. Other positives were rising stock prices, reduced first-time claims for unemployment insurance, and increased building permits. Offsetting negatives included gloomier consumer expectations and weaker factory orders for consumer goods. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Pharmaceutical giant Merck has reported a 7% jump in its second quarter net income as increased sales offset higher spending on marketing and research, but the results missed analyst expectations by one penny and Merck shares dipped 3% in morning trading. A federal judge in New York has dismissed the NAACP's lawsuit against gun makers, the judge ruling that the group failed to prove in a recent trial that the gun industry's marketing practices have caused harm to its members. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
As heavy fighting continued to engulf the Liberian capital of Monrovia today, mortar fire hit the U.S. Embassy, which is in a particularly embattled part of the capital. Liberians have been trying to shelter in and around the embassy for days to escape street battles. A small number of Marines guard the heavily fortified compound. A larger contingent of 40 or more was to arrive today. For weeks, President Bush has been weighing whether or not to put a much larger force of U.S. peacekeepers in Liberia, a country founded by former U.S. slaves 150 years ago. Michael Peel is the West Africa correspondent of the Financial Times. He's in Lagos, Nigeria at the moment. And Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thanks, Michael. Michael, I see a photograph in the paper just today, shirtless, teenaged fighters wearing flip-flops on their feet, wildly firing automatic weapons in the streets of Monrovia. Who's fighting whom in Liberia?
Well, the main fighting that we're seeing at the moment is between forces loyal to President Charles Taylor, a former warlord who won an election in 1997, and a rebel movement known as Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy, which has been fighting Mr. Taylor since 1999. And, of course, this comes in the context of 15 years where Liberia has been in and out of war, first of all in a civil war in 1989-96, where Mr. Taylor emerged as the leading warlord from the various armed factions.
Now
this is giving way to this latest conflict.
Yeah. Now, Michael, does either side in this conflict have a particular gripe with the U.S. that the embassy would be targeted?
Well, I think U.S. officials are playing down that aspect, saying that they don't think the embassy was being targeted as an attack on the U.S. What is true is that Mr. Taylor's government is certainly unhappy with the position that the U.S. has taken in terms of calling on Mr. Taylor to step down, as President Bush did several weeks ago. And it's also true, as you said in your introduction, that there are lots of Liberians who've been driven from their homes and have gone to seek sanctuary around the embassy, and it may be that someone is targeting the area precisely because of that, either from the rebel side or from the government side, as a way of saying that you know, your people are not safe, even if you seek refuge outside the embassy of the most powerful country in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Michael, just in the minute or so we have left, could the rebels take over, and what would happen if they did?
Well, I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that question. This latest battle appears to be the third attempt in the past month or so by the rebels to take Monrovia. Not many people seem to know very much about the rebels. It's alleged that they are supported by neighbouring Guinea, which has been loggerheads with the Taylor government, so Guinea denies this. As to what would happen if they did take over the city, again, that's really not clear, since the rebels haven't really outlined much of an agenda beyond unseating Mr. Taylor from power.
Thank you, Michael, very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Peel of the Financial Times recently returned from Liberia, where he spoke to us from Lagos, Nigeria.
Portions of documents declassified last week to deflect criticism of intelligence about Iraq may actually end up having the opposite effect. In addition to exploring the existence of weapons of mass destruction, the papers also reveal that intelligence officials believed last fall that Saddam Hussein was unlikely to give biological or chemical weapons to terrorists unless his rule was directly threatened by the United States. The National Intelligence Estimate was a joint effort by six intelligence services who produced their report at the request of President Bush. But the administration continued to warn of the terrorist threat posed by the Iraqi regime, even as the assessment reported that an attack on Saddam would actually increase the terrorist threat to the U.S. Walter Pincus is the Washington Post staff writer reporting this story. He joins us now. Hello.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, tell us exactly, if you could pick a few phrases out, what the report says about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction.
Well, it makes clear that there are limitations the intelligence people feel about Saddam Hussein's use of chemical or perhaps biological weapons. One, that he probably wouldn't use them unless he was attacked and unless the attack really threatened the administration, because that would undermine his whole sort of policy with the rest of the world. But more importantly, it says he would only give them to terrorists if, and their phrase is, if he was sufficiently desperate, he might do that, and only as a kind of last chance to exact revenge.
And this, what the assessment says, seems to directly contradict what the president was telling the nation at the time.
Well, back in October, he was telling the nation that he could turn over chemical or biological weapons to terrorists on any day, and therefore was a threat. The irony being that on May 1st, if you believe the intelligence assessment, on May 1st, Saddam was still alive. His was in a desperate position. And our concern about him giving weapons to terrorists should be greater, but the president said he no longer could do it.
Mm. How much of this information did Congress, many members supported the president's case for war, how much did the members of Congress have access to this report?
They had access, at least the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, and the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committee did get briefed on this. And in fact, it was Senator Graham, who was chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that forced the administration to at least publish two sentences that had some of the implications of when Saddam would or would not use chemical weapons.
So what do you make of this?
Well, I think it appears to be just another situation where the administration cherry-picked out of intelligence reports that were classified the information that supported the idea that Saddam Hussein was a threat and an immediate threat in order to get Congress to vote to give the president authority to go to war and to get the UN to support the same thing.
What reaction are you getting from people to your report?
Well, people have been for the last week or two under a sort of barrage of these kinds of reanalysis of what was said. And I think the public at large is still trying to make up its mind, and Congress is clearly going to investigate to see if this kind of exaggeration that's taken place is worth trying to stop in some way.
And as you say in your article, somewhat ironically, Saddam Hussein is in the exact position now, if he, as is believed is alive in Iraq, that the assessment said would be the situation in which he might use weapons or give them to terrorists.
Exactly.
Walter Pincus, thank you.
You're welcome.
Washington Post staff writer Walter Pincus speaking to us from Washington, D.C.
Well, as we just heard, questions continue to swarm about how members of the Bush administration and the president himself allegedly presented, or some say managed, and some say hyped, intelligence about how much Saddam Hussein's Iraq threatened the United States. Senator Edward Kennedy was never persuaded military action against Iraq was necessary. He voted against a congressional resolution last fall authorizing the president to use military force. In January, he said war in Iraq was the wrong war at the wrong time. And a week ago, he said our troops in post-war Iraq were now sitting ducks. We're joined now by the senior senator from Massachusetts, Edward Kennedy. Welcome, Senator.
Good morning.
Senator, a week ago you said the nation was taken to war under false pretenses, that the case for war was built on, and I quote, hyped intelligence, even false intelligence. Now, Senator, a president was impeached for lying about sexual misbehavior. Do you believe the president lied about intelligence to justify war in Iraq?
I never believed that Iraq posed an imminent security threat to the United States. It always appeared to me that the Bush administration had made up its mind about going to war with Iraq and then tried to develop the justification for that policy. But we have to deal with where we are now. Now we are in a situation where we have a bankrupt, failed, flawed policy in Iraq that's adrift, and American servicemen are paying the price every single day. It's like a shooting gallery over there. We should go to the United Nations, put a resolution to the United Nations, a resolution to NATO. After all, it's in the world community's interest to have an Iraq that is free and secure.
Senator, how likely do you think it is that this administration will go to the UN or will go to NATO for support in our efforts in Iraq?
Well, it's been unwilling to do so. Now, we have a successful policy of working through NATO and the United Nations. It's worked in Kosovo. It's worked in Bosnia. It's worked in East Timor. Why won't the United States now effectively put aside its arrogant go-it-alone approach to foreign policy and take real action to secure a broader role for the international community?
Well, I ask you, Senator, why don't you think this administration will go to NATO or the UN?
It seems to be it is following a go-it-alone, chip-of-the-shoulder foreign policy. It's been very selective in when it wants to involve any of the foreign countries. They give lip service to this. When we're looking at North Korea, which is an extraordinarily dangerous security issue today, but with regards to Iraq, it has made up its mind since it went to the war effectively alone, it's going to win the peace. And we have seen as the Hamry report, a former Deputy Secretary of Defense that came back just a day or two ago, points out that we probably have got 60 to 90 days that are going to be the critical time of whether there's just going to be chaos in Iraq or whether there's going to be meaningful, ongoing and developing security and the building and the construction of democratic institutions. I believe that the international community would respond as they have. We have German troops, French troops that are serving in Afghanistan. We have worked through the United Nations even in the actual appointment of Karzai in Afghanistan. We have a pathway which has demonstrated success in the past. We ought to take that pathway now.
Senator, a presidential election campaign already underway. Are your fellow Democrats who are running for president as forthright in presenting their positions on Iraq as you think they should be?
It seems to me that it's what is needed over there now is increasingly clear, and the candidates are speaking to it. The deepest concern that I have, having listened last week to Don Rumsfeld, is that they're just not getting it. The administration is refusing to budge, refusing to move. It's only going to move when the American people and the Congress create the kind of climate and atmosphere which says this go-it-alone, my way or the highway, foreign policy makes no sense in terms of our interest. We ought to be focused on that approach in Iraq, and we ought to get about the business of giving greater focus and attention and priority to the dangers of a nuclear development in North Korea. That poses, I believe, the greatest security threat to the United States today, and we just don't have a policy with regards to North Korea.
Senator Ted Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thanks a lot.
Senator Ted Kennedy, senior senator from Massachusetts.
Just ahead, the weapon that changed the world and its creator, Mikhail Kalashnikov. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Here's a sound you may or may not recognize, but anyone who has heard it up close will never forget it. That's the sound of one of the best designed, most durable and reliable machines of the industrial age. It's the AK-47 assault weapon. The AK stands for Automatic Kalashnikov. Now, many of the Kalashnikovs that flood today's battlefields, and estimates are as high as 75 million worldwide, have been sold and smuggled and resold. The AK in the hands of a child soldier in Liberia or Sierra Leone probably served in several other wars, from Afghanistan to Africa. Well, airing tonight on the Sundance cable channel is a documentary about the Kalashnikov and the man who designed it to fight the Nazis. His name is Mikhail Kalashnikov. Well, William Hartung is a professor at the World Policy Institute at the New School in New York. He's an expert on small arms proliferation worldwide, and he joins us today to talk about the AK-47. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. Bill, let's begin with the man who designed the weapon and who's at the center of this documentary. He's quite an interesting, multi-layered character, is he not? Let's first listen for a moment to hear him talk about some of his ambivalence about having created this weapon.
Back then, I never had time to think about whether I might ever be going to hell. Not because of my personal qualities, but because of my job, which has made me an enemy of society. Today, I think I never had a choice. Sure, you can get lucky and become a gardener, farmer, or veterinarian. But me, I'm a weapons designer, and that explains everything.
Mikhail Kalashnikov, a Russian, of course. That's the English translation in the new documentary. Bill Hartung, tell us about him.
Well, he's fascinating for a number of reasons. First of all, he's a merchant of death who didn't make any real money off his own invention.
Yeah.
Because he did it in the Soviet system. He gets a little dacha with hot water that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. They show him giving a speech. You know, he got medals and a uniform, which he dusts off every once in a while. There's a speech where he, you know, says, you know, I too am not getting my pension check this month. So, you know, it's very different from the stereotype of the notion that these guys are in it, for the money. He argues in the sections where he's being interviewed live with his Russian handler that he did it, you know, for the fatherland. He wanted it to be ready to fight off the Nazis, but it was not ready for that. It didn't come to being until after World War II. But then there's this whole other Kalashnikov that you hear because the filmmakers had access to his diaries. And that Kalashnikov, who's not having a minder look over his shoulder, is quite anguished, much like Alfred Nobel, who created the Nobel Peace Prize, was anguished about what his invention has done. I had the chance at a meeting at the UN on the small arms issue earlier this month to meet journalists who had been in Vietnam who saw these things in action. I met a woman who, unbeknownst to me, works on my issue of arms control, who spent 20 years in the Army, who said, well, you know, on the one hand, Bill, if I had an M16, you know, I could kill you from four blocks away and you wouldn't know what hit you. But, you know, if I was going to go out into the jungle, I would take the AK every time because it rattles around like an old skeleton, but it's indestructible. And so a guerrilla movement, a terrorist, anybody can use this thing, can maintain it. You don't need a big logistics tail. So it's almost an invention that was too good in a way because it's been very hard to get rid of these things.
Kalashnikov himself lived a strange existence, didn't he? 50 years in kind of a secret city in the Soviet Union, a city mostly devoted to creating weapons and the arms industry.
Yes, and that was sort of news to me, even though this is my field. I had heard a lot about the secret nuclear cities, and it didn't occur to me that, you know, working on a conventional weapon like the AK-47, that would also be the case. But, of course, it was a very security-conscious state, and this is also part of the problem of the proliferation with the breakup of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was very good at repressing people, and it was very good at keeping track of its stuff. And when they broke up, these states that they left behind, both in East and Central Europe and the republics to the south, had very little to offer up onto the global market. They weren't paying their soldiers. So a lot of the guns showing up in the conflicts in Africa were coming from Bulgaria, were coming from these former Soviet states, because this was something that they had. They had hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these AK-47s. They would sell them to brokers. This was something that they could just plug into the global marketplace and get cash in return. So there was a lot of short-sighted thinking at the end of the Cold War because people didn't really think of these things as particularly dangerous. They were worried about the nuclear weapons. They weren't worried about the lowly AK-47, and they should have been.
So small arms. All our lives we've heard about nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological. We hear a lot about that now. Here's a sound you may or may not recognize, but anyone who has heard it up close will never forget it.
Of a communal dispute, or Pakistan, or in Rwanda, start shooting off 100 rounds to settle a dispute, and you kill 10, 20, 3 dozen people. You know, that's not a family grudge anymore. All of a sudden, you've got a civil war on your hands. So it's almost like the notion of calling them small arms is a misnomer. These are almost like a slow-motion weapon of mass destruction that can rip open the fabric of a whole society.
Bill Hartung, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
William Hartung is a professor at the World Policy Institute at the New School in New York.
And this reminder, you can watch the documentary Automatic Kalashnikov tonight on the Sundance Channel.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, across the country, thousands of military families wait for their loved ones to return from Iraq. We'll talk to one man whose 22-year-old son has had a couple of delayed homecomings.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community. On the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, how is the U.S. doing in post-war Iraq? Depends on who you talk to. Our D.C. roundtable convenes in Washington and Baghdad.
And move over, Beach Boys. Our folk music maestro joins us with the folk songs of summer.
What modern folk music, I think, takes from that old tradition, however, is a belief that there should be songs about all of life's experiences, not just mating and dating the way so much of pop is. So even in the modern folk world, you can find songs that are just for summer.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dave Faniff with these news headlines. U.S. Embassy compound in Monrovia, Liberia has come under mortar fire. This is heavy casualties are being reported in Liberia's capital as rebel and government forces battle for the city. Reporter Barry Schweid has more.
In the struggle for control of Liberia, there's been random gunfire at the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia, the capital of the African country. A U.S. official in Washington says bullets have been pinging buildings in the embassy complex, but that the embassy itself has not been targeted or damaged and is staying open. It's not clear in the random shooting who has been firing at embassy buildings.
An elite squad of 41 U.S. Marines arrived in Liberia this morning to beef up security at the embassy. A roadside bomb kills an American soldier in Baghdad. It exploded near a U.S. military convoy, killing the soldier and his Iraqi interpreter. Three other members of the 1st Armored Division were injured. The bombing, which hit two Humvees, has brought the number of U.S. troops killed in action to 152. President Bush at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, says Iran and Syria continue to harbor terrorists. This as 16 suspected terrorists have been arrested in Saudi Arabia, and officials there say they have foiled a number of terrorist plots. According to a Saudi Interior Ministry official, security forces found weapons, including rocket-propelled grenades and nearly 160 pounds of explosives. Meanwhile, in Germany, two men wanted by the U.S. on charges of supporting al-Qaeda will apparently be turned over to U.S. authorities. U.S. officials say they believe one of the men supplied millions of dollars along with recruits and weapons to Osama bin Laden in the years leading up to 9/11. A federal judge has dismissed the NAACP's lawsuit against gun makers, ruling that while the group did show that gun retailers were careless, it did not show that its members were uniquely harmed. The lawsuit claimed the gun industry knew corrupt dealers were supplying products to criminals and minority communities but did nothing to stop it. Gun makers argued that it was unfair to hold manufacturers liable for the criminal use of a legal product. Parts of Iowa are reeling from strong storms that spawned tornadoes in the state last night. The storms knocked out power to some 35,000 homes and businesses in the area of northeast Iowa. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 102 points at 9086.04. The Nasdaq off 28 at 1676.35. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, flew back to Washington this week to consult with the White House about the conflict that he predicted could last for years. Bremer also said on his round of Sunday's morning talk shows that Saddam Hussein is alive and the sooner we can either kill him or capture him, the better. But he added, dead or alive, this guy is finished in Iraq. Well, Senator Jay Rockefeller, Democrat from West Virginia, has also just flown in from Iraq, and he says Paul Bremer doesn't grasp the full extent of Hussein's influence on Iraqis or the danger American troops are in. The U.S. role in Iraq, that's the focus of this week's D.C. Roundtable. In Washington, we're joined by Carl Lubsdorf. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Carl, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
And speaking to us from Baghdad, Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Welcome, Andrea.
Hi, Robin.
Well, let's start with you on your satellite phone there. Paul Bremer told you in an interview that there's no evidence the Iraqis want the U.S. to go home. Well, we've got two more deaths today, two yesterday, several more in total than the Gulf War deaths. What does Paul Bremer interpret those deaths to mean?
I think he's talking to maybe some of the wrong people, or not the same people that I've been talking to and other people have been talking to in the streets. I think Bremer has been sort of cocooned. He's in this sort of security bubble in a cocoon where he talks to a lot of the establishment folks, if you will, and a lot of people who were exiles for many years who are just coming back in the last few months. I think on the street, yes, there are people who are glad to be rid of Saddam, and there are people who welcome the American soldiers, although they sure would like to have some electricity, you know, and would like to have some water running, you know, on a regular basis, and they certainly would like to have some security, which there isn't here at all. In fact, I'm standing on a roof, and, you know, I can hear explosions and gunfire, you know, every now and then. It's just kind of part of the background noise here.
Carl, let's turn to you in Washington. I mentioned that Jay Rockefeller, a Democrat who has also made a visit to Iraq, says that Bremer is underestimating Saddam Hussein's grip on the country. Do you think Andrea is right that maybe Jay Rockefeller is talking to the right people? Or is this whole debate about post-war Iraq getting politicized?
Well, of course, everything is politicized. But, you know, when you have reporters on the scene saying something and congressmen and senators visiting there saying basically the same thing, you have to give it a lot of credence. And I think it's in the interest of the administration and Mr. Bremer into basically making the situation seem more secure possibly than it is, making it seem that they're making progress. One assumes they're making progress, but maybe not as fast as they have. And, you know, he said Saddam Hussein is finished, but it's an awful slow finish. And I think everyone is aware that as long as he remains out there, this is going to be a very serious and dangerous situation. And for the administration's point of view, along with its problems with intelligence and thus, you know, it's clearly underestimated the degree to which the post-war period would be difficult. And the longer it goes on like that, the more it's going to be damaged.
Yeah, and as we heard early in the program from Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, there's a sense that Saddam Hussein might be at his most dangerous now, that he is cornered and possibly in hiding in the country. Well, Andrea, let's talk about some of the post-war plans that are taking effect. General Abizaid's plans, for instance, about the new Iraqi role in defending the country.
I think it's really key to get Iraqis out here on the street, to take some of the security burden off of the troops. You know, Iraqis can speak the same language as the people here. You know, I see so many times where soldiers just can't, you know, communicate simple instructions to Iraqis. It's just a failure to communicate. So, you know, this weekend they started recruiting for the new Iraqi army, as they're calling it, but that's going to be a couple of years down the road, and even when they've got that, in 2 years, they're only going to have 40,000 troops, which is one-tenth the size of what Saddam's army was. And just in the last couple of days, General Abizaid said that their new plans now for an Iraqi militia that would take some of the internal security role, maybe replace some of those troops on the street. And I think that's a good idea because, again, you want to really lower the U.S. presence, the profile, if you will, on the street.
Yeah, well, as we talked to a soldier in Baghdad last week who said, I really hope they screen those Iraqis who are going to be taking over some of the security. I mean, there's concern, as she expressed it, among U.S. soldiers that unless these are really well screened, they may add to the danger that the U.S. soldiers are in.
Well, I think that's, you know, certainly a concern. You just don't know who is a friend and who is a foe here. And I think a lot of these ambushes and attacks on soldiers just came out of nowhere. I had a story in the paper last week about a soldier who was shot point blank at Baghdad University on July 6th. He was just going to buy a soda, and somebody came up from behind and shot him in the back of the head, you know, just like that, and disappeared into the crowd. So you don't really know who to trust and who not.
Yeah. Carl, how is the administration reacting to these deaths?
Well, I think they're very concerned about this. You know, for all the debate about weapons of mass destruction, the thing that really can damage an administration, we've seen this time and again, is the idea that Americans are being killed abroad, especially in a situation that's, you know, not under control. And as the toll goes up, I think you're going to see a lot of publicity that you already see the president's approval going down. It's not precipitously down. It's down about where it was before the war. And if it really begins to sink below that level, then you can believe that he's really got political problems.
Andrea, in Iraq, the American-backed administration there, the Defense Council, was supposed to have picked a president last week. Instead, they settled on a rotating leadership. What happened there, and what's the effect of that?
I think that just points to what a diverse and fractious group this is, that the Americans, the coalition, is basically put together. It was really striking last week. I was at the introduction, if you will, of a governing council, and it was just, you know, a lot of people who didn't have a lot to say to each other, and not everybody was included. This week there have been demonstrations here in Baghdad and down in Najaf. You know, they've got this cleric who's been left out of the process, and he's kind of stirring up his own people down in Najaf and here in Baghdad. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Well, and Carl, the Bush administration, I'm sure, like the rest of America, picked up their papers this morning and saw Iraqis once again protesting soldiers, this time on the rumor that that Shia cleric that Andrea was talking about was going to be arrested. How do you spin control this?
You do what Mr. Bremer did on television yesterday. You say, we're going to be there a long time, but we're gradually getting the situation under control, and that it's Americans have to be prepared for, you know, for a drawn-out period there. The administration's got, you know, problems here. It's got problems with the report on the 9/11 investigation coming out later this week. So, I mean, it's got some of their foreign policy efforts, which have been their strength, at least politically, are under a great deal of question. And the uncertainty in Iraq is certainly a big part of that.
Mm. Well, and as you mentioned, we'll be looking forward to that report on 9/11. Carl, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Andrew, thanks so much from Baghdad.
My pleasure.
Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today, speaking to us from Baghdad. Carl Lubsdorf, Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News in Washington, both members of our D.C. roundtable.
Still to come, folk music for summertime with resident folkie Scott Allerup.
You're listening to Here and Now. The practice of collecting rain in a barrel to water your garden is an ancient one, but one that's making a comeback. Across the country, gardening groups hold seminars on do-it-yourself rain barrels, and a Massachusetts company is partnering with local communities to make it cheaper for residents to buy one. Joining us on the line is Jack Friel. He founded the New England Rain Barrel Company. Welcome, Jack.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Well, when I heard about your company, I thought, you know, what's the big deal? You get one of those barrels with the wooden staves and the metal hoops, but no, it's far more advanced than that. Tell me about your barrel. Describe it.
Okay, the barrel is actually what's called a closed-head 55-gallon plastic barrel. Mm-hmm. These were previously used in the food industry. We retrofit them so that they can be installed under the downspout of your house to catch rainwater. And then you can fit a hose to a spigot at the bottom of the rain barrel in order to distribute water in your garden.
What a great idea. What about overflow, though?
Well, we have another spigot at the side, near the top of the barrel, and you can put a hose on that so that if you're worried about water around the foundation of your house, you can run a hose out behind the garage or wherever you want the extra water to go to.
It's such a great idea. And I hear also that because it's closed, You can also avoid insects. How do you keep the water from, you know, going bad, though, if it's sitting there? Does it matter if it's going to be used in gardens?
Well, the first thing is these barrels are blue, and that keeps the ultraviolet light out. The ultraviolet light not getting in means that you really won't be growing any kind of moss or anything on the inside of the barrel.
And at the rate that we water our gardens, it won't be sitting there that long anyway. Is that why communities have been so anxious to work with you on this? I know that you have deals with many local communities so that people can buy the barrel for a little bit cheaper than the... What is the cost?
The barrel's $59 wholesale. Now, our retail price is $85, but the idea is that if we can get large groups of people to buy them and we can deliver them all to one place, then we can pass along the wholesale savings on to the end user.
And obviously there's a savings to Mother Earth if less water is used from communities, if it comes from the heavens instead. But how much do you estimate an average person can save by using rainwater instead of, let's say, garden hose water?
Well, I can give you, for instance, we developed this rain barrel last summer, in the summer of 2002. And it was the driest summer we've had in years and years and years. And my wife never turned the hose on the side of the house. She used strictly rainwater to water her gardens. You know, they say that easily a third of all the water that you use in your home in a year is just, you know, going right into the ground. So if you think about how much water you use throughout the year and what you're spending, you might be able to take a third of that right off the top.
And by the way, was that the mother of this invention, your own gardening needs?
Absolutely. We lived in Europe for a few years, and when we came back, we had the driest winter on record. Maybe you remember 2001. We just didn't have any snow. So Joan turned to me and said, Jack, you got to figure out how to make a rain barrel. And that's exactly how it all started. And we made one, and our neighbors saw it, and they wanted me to make a barrel for them, and so on and so on, and that's the story.
Well, there you go, and now you're riding the wave of a trend. Well, Jack, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Robin, to speak with you, and I certainly hope that people get the idea of the blue barrel for the green owner.
Okay. Jack Friel, owner and founder of the New England Rain Barrel Company. For more on his company's upcoming events, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Summer has a culture all its own. Rituals like backyard barbecues, baseball, the beach, concerts under the stars. But aside from Take Me Out to the Ball Game and Gershwin's Summertime, what are the songs of summer? Well, our folk critic Scott Alaric is in the studio to help answer that important question for us. And welcome, Scott.
Always great to be here, Bill.
So folk music is associated, really, with summertime, probably because of all the festivals and so on. But what about throughout history? What's the music of summer?
Well, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of songs of summer anymore the way there are for Christmas, for example. Christmas seems to be the only time that has seasonal music anymore. And we call them carols. But a carol originally meant any song that was meant for dancing. And they were songs that were sung at various community rituals, and particularly at seasonal holidays and feast days. So there were sheep shearing and harvesting and a lot of summer carols that have just fallen out of use as agrarian society got more mechanized and we became more urbanized. What modern folk music, I think, takes from that old tradition, however, is a belief that there should be songs about all of life's experiences, not just mating and dating, the way so much of pop is. So even in the modern folk world, you can find songs that are just for summer.
So what folk music embodies summer for you?
There's a great CD put out by a couple of inveterate fly fishers and bluegrassers in Idaho, Ben Winship and David Thompson, called Fishing Music. And what's great about this CD, it's an anthology devoted not so much to fishing itself, but to the culture of fishing, to the idea of fishing as a discipline of idleness, purposeful sloth, and dedicated laziness. Listen to the opening track here, sung by the great Colorado bluegrass diva Molly O'Brien. It really lays out the thesis.
Important part of fishing ain't the fish, but the fishing. Important part of loving is the love. The important part of doing most anything you do is doing it with all of your heart. 'Cause if the fish don't bite, you get some time for thinking, and your lover's who you're thinking about. And if your love is not with you, you get some time for fishing. It's amazing how it all works out.
A lovely thesis there, as you called it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, fishing. What about water as a theme for summer music?
Well, we all know sea shanties, those yo-ho-ho songs. But there are some newer songs of the sea, too. If you're going to spend any time near the ocean this summer, I really recommend listening to the music of Gordon Bach, a guy from Camden, Maine. Time magazine once called him the poet laureate of those who go down to the sea in ships. He writes very modern songs, but with a real understanding of how myth is used in poetry and storytelling. His songs ponder the world around him by moving from the seen to the unseen world, from the real to the imagined, and from the human to the animal world. He has a whole CD devoted to songs about schooners and several epic ballads exploring the ancient seal girl myths of changelings who are seals in the water and humans on land. And he's got a new album that's all about herring and herring fishing. And he did something I wish more older songwriters would do. He's reconsidered some of the songs he sang when he was a young man. This one is called Herring Croon, and in his new interpretation, although he plays it pretty much the same way, this imagined conversation between a fisherman and a herring fish, he really reminds us what a dangerous, mortal place the natural world is.
Where do you go, little herring? What do you see, tail and fin? Blue and green, cold and dark, seaweed growing high. Hills 100 fathom deep, where the dead men lie. Dogfish eyes and mackerel's eyes, and they hunger after me. Net or where, I don't care. Catch me if you can.
But I love the way he brings that out, that down where the dead men lie. He reminds this fisherman that this may be a sport to him, but this is real life and death stuff.
Well, life and death stuff for a lot of people is baseball in the summer, and there's certainly music around that too, isn't there?
Right. Well, you know, it seems like there's nothing but take me out to the ballgame.
Yeah.
But there's a great songwriter who grew up in Philadelphia and now lives in Chicago, so he knows all about the heartache of the baseball fan, named Chuck Brodsky, and he's put out a great album called Baseball Ballads. In the best instincts of the pop, folk songwriter, he looks for the unsung heroes, for the players whose stories haven't been told. He writes about a pitcher named Doc Ellis who once threw a no-hitter while on LSD, and Eddie Klepp, a white man who crossed the color barrier in baseball to play with the Negro Leagues. But if anybody ever deserved a folk ballad, it's the luckless Fred Merkel.
One of those names you can't make up.
No, exactly. In 1908, his teammate scored the winning run in a key game. But Merkel went to the clubhouse without touching second. And by an obscure rule that I think has since been changed, he was ruled out, the run was canceled, and the game was declared a tie. As the season played out, they had to replay that game to decide who would win the pennant that year, and Merkel's team lost.
Oh.
Now, there's a couple of things to learn from this. First of all, if you're going to have something like this happen to you, try not to be playing for a New York team because they're very unforgiving about these things. And try, please try, not to have a name like Fred Merkel.
Sounds like it could be a blues.
Exactly. Well, this is what Chuck Brodsky sings. This is what happened after the New York Giants lost what was forever to be known as the Merkel game.
They would play the Merkel game and feet five for fun. The Giants lost the pennant. Merkel was the bum. Papers let him have it. Well, they gave it to him good. They ran the kind of headlines only New York papers could. Well, they dubbed him Bonehead Merkel and made up Merkel words. One might pull a Merkel, and to Merkel became a verb. Some would yell, touch second, Bonehead, when he stood on first. Little kids yelled, moron, and the older kids much worse.
Summer is also a time for families. Families, of course, often go to baseball games together, but they're also sometimes out on the road together or doing this or that, picnics, whatever.
Yeah.
Families in summer.
Right, right. I think this is a real problem in our culture. For marketing reasons, we've divided ourselves up into all these neat demographic groups that are never supposed to have anything in common. There are songs called family music, but, you know, they're usually kiddie songs that parents can clap along to and also name their favorite animal friends, but songs that really explore what it's like to live in a family, the problems that parents and grandparents and children all share together. It's so hard to find songs like that in pop music today. There's a Appalachian folk singer named John McCutcheon, who I think writes about family life better than anyone I've ever heard. He writes about the fun stuff, like fishing in the local swimming hole, but also the tough stuff, you know, how parents and kids feel about growing up and leaving home, keeping communication lines open, learning to let go and to let kids grow themselves up. He's put out a brilliant 4-CD cycle of family songs for the whole family for each of the seasons on the Rounder Kids label. And on the Summer Songs CD, he sings about the travails of those first haircuts and the unbridled joys of mud, but also about bugs and sweaty nights, the pitfalls of camping. But there's a song called Dad and Me, where he portrays a child of divorce who spends summers with Dad, and the kid's on the way to go visit the dad. And McCutcheon doesn't lay a judgment on this situation. What he does is he writes a song for people in this situation so they can have a song that they can listen to and explore it together. I think this is folk music at its best and its most valuable.
Winter is a cold time, snow is on the ground, and fall is when the leaves fall from the tree. Springtime is a good time, 'cause school is out at last. But summertime is time for Dad and me.
That's really sweet, sort of tender stuff there.
Yeah, but he really goes at the painfulness of that situation, too. And it's really something that families can listen to together and talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, summer, a time that brings families together and all of us together around music sometimes. And we've got a feel for some of the folk music of summer from Scott Alaric. And Scott, thanks a lot for coming in and bringing us some of the songs of summer.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Bill.
Here and Now's folk music reviewer, Scott Alaric. For a list of Scott's songs of summer, visit our website, here-now.org.
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And for more information on the show, visit our website, here-now.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.